before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think.
Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn about them here.
Well, don't settle for the first, for it might be the worst.
And welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. As always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. We've got lots of great interviews for you this month, but before we get started with those, let's get into beer news. Seward Brewing Company closed for the season on Sunday, September 6th. It will reopen in May of 2021. 49th State Brewing Company has completed an extensive remodel of its Healy Brew Pub, located just outside the entrance to Denali National Park. Its seating area has more than doubled, and the brewery has been opened up so that patrons have a view into it. For 2020, the Juno Rotary has converted its annual Capital Brewfest into Pintdemic, in which participants will purchase a passport and then visit all four local area breweries on their own between October 1st and November 30th. After visiting each brewery and purchasing a special beer, participants will get their passports stamped. Once completed, the stamped passports can be exchanged for commemorative glass. Kenai River Brewing has resumed its happy hour food specials. These small plates are available from 3 to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Thursday in the tap room. Kodiak Island Brewing Company has opened a new outdoor patio alongside the brewery. We'll have more details when we interview owner Ben Milstein later in the show. A new beer bar is opening soon in downtown Anchorage. The Tent City Tap House will be at 320 West 5th Avenue in what used to be the Crush Wine Bar. There will be 24 taps pouring 100% local beers. The owners plan to try to source beers seldom seen in Anchorage, with beers from Black Spruce Brewing and Hoodoo Brewing in Fairbanks, Cooper Landing Brewing, Valdez Brewing, Girdwood Brewing, and even Grace Ridge Brewing in Homer. Eventually, they hope to go even farther afield, bringing in beers from the smaller breweries in Southeast Alaska. The U.S. Department of Justice has approved the sale of the Craft Brew Alliance to Anheuser-Busch InBev. AB InBev announced the acquisition more than 10 months ago, but the Antitrust Division of the DOJ has now granted final approval. Craft Brew Alliance started as a merger between Portland's Widmer Brothers and Seattle's Red Hook, the latter dating back almost four decades. In 2019, Widmer's brands accounted for just 13% of the Craft Brewing Alliance's production, and Red Hook's a feeble 8%. Both have been declining for years, and their prospects are dim. It's likely that the main reason behind the purchase was the acquisition of the beer portfolio belonging to Kona Brewing, which was purchased by Craft Brewers Alliance 10 years ago. That's it for this month's beer news. Up next, an interview with Reed McDonald, one of the owners of Odd Man Rush Brewing in Eagle River, Alaska. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Hello, and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here with Reed McDonald, one of the owners of Odd Man Rush Brewing in Eagle River. Hey, Reed, how are you today?
Great, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for doing it for us. So, hey, for listeners who may not be totally familiar with it, why don't you tell them a little bit about Odd Man Rush?
Well, Odd Man Rush, we started, actually, we're about to celebrate our fifth anniversary, believe it or not. But my partners and I, Brian Swanson and Ross Johnson, started out as home brewers, quickly kind of gained a following with our family and friends, and then kind of got to the point where we were kind of, I don't want to say forced into it, but people were like, you guys got to open something in Eagle River. So we took the giant leap of faith and many sleepless nights building our place. And we have a nice little neighborhood brewery in Eagle River.
Yeah, I visited it a while back, and it really is nice, and even nicer now, right? You guys just finished doing I wouldn't exactly call it an expansion, but kind of a renovation, and you got an upstairs now and everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, we pride ourselves in our tap room, our original tap room, and we did we're in kind of an industrial strip mall, so we did take the next step and rented the next unit next to us, so we added 2,100 square feet. And a little more tap room, but more it was for the production side, as we were kind of limited. We had three fermenters, and once we got up and running, you know, our flagship beers kind of took over, and then it was really hard to get in and do something creative. In the meantime, now that we have more, we've got three more fermenters and another bright tank and area for a future canning line, so it allows us to be a little more creative and get little one-offs out more often than we were not able to do before. We have a premier system. It's a 10-barrel brew house. And when we were home brewers, we did a fair amount of research going to the CBC a few years in a row, and then just nagging brewers and asking owners if we could see their spot. I think I remember in the 2014 CBC, I think we hit 25 breweries in our off time of not being at the actual conference, but and then just kind of picking everyone's brain as much as they would allow. Most of them were gracious and let us have a peek and gave us some good insight. So yeah, we decided to go with the Premier system. They were had a good reputation. Started out with 320 barrel fermenters, thinking that, you know, naive as we were, like, we'll open this place up and, you know, maybe in 5 years we'll be double batching and that. Well, the double batching started pretty much right after we opened. I mean, I think it was like 2 months and we were already starting to double batch of beers. So that was a good move, but I mean, it was going so fast and furious that then we bought three 30 barrel fermenters. One was an old, we bought it used off of Broken Tooth. And I think it was one of the original ones. It was a specific vessel, and I think that Clark over there at Cynosure has the rest of the fermenters in the brew house. I think it was it looks like it belongs in that realm. I'm not really totally sure of that, but I think it was part of that. That was the old railway brewing system back in the day. So yep. Now we've got six fermenters and a little more freedom.
Well, good. That seems to be the typical experience for most breweries that open up here in Alaska, is whatever they think they're going to need, they turn out to have underestimated it, and they're immediately, that's why I always recommend to people, buy a bigger system than you think you're going to need, because past experience shows that demand is going to outstrip whatever you thought it was going to be. So that's
big time. I mean, I remember actually it was Gabe over there at ABC. He, I didn't know Gabe real well. He's a rock star brewer and a great guy, but I did not know him very well. And a mutual friend introduced us. And so I was telling you, at that point I had bought a 3-barrel system used from a guy down in Seattle, and that system actually ended up with Eddie out of Gakona Brewing. But I remember meeting with Gabe, and he was just breaking ground on his facility there, which is beautiful. And I remember him looking at me and going, oh, you're 3-barrel, huh? I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, I've never had your beer, but if it's any good, you guys are going to be on brewing on that system like 24/7. So do you like your family? I'm like, yeah, I like my family. Say, well, you will never see them because you'll be brewing on that 3-barrel system. So I remember, armed with that, I came back to the boys and I was like, guys, we need money and we need a bigger system. So I'm glad he gave me that bit of advice back in the day, because I cannot imagine starting on something smaller after starting with a 10-barrel, and making that jump from a home brewer to a 10-barrel system is very intimidating, to say the least. But I wish we'd have went bigger. I think that's another common theme too. It's like you go 10, you know, go 15 if you can afford it, because it's worth it.
Yep, definitely. So tell us a little bit about the different beers that you brew, and also where people can find them besides at your brewery there.
Yeah, well, our brewery model is more of a tap room kind of first business model when we first opened up. I think that Hoodoo had the really first really cool tap room where I went in there. I'm like, no, this is what I want to see in Eagle River, and just the community vibe and whatnot. So that's kind of our model, and we've been growing very slow, I think, but smart, and not getting too far ahead of ourselves. So we sell 90% of our beer in our tap room, and we are, I don't know why, but we're the only brewery in Eagle River. So that helps. And our beers now, I mean, we do mostly clean beers, although I do fancy some sour beers, and I want to, now that I'm on board and we have more time and Swanee's not just, we're not slave driving him as much as we did before. We want to expand our lineup and try some different things. So getting into some sour beers is something I'd like to do as well. But yeah, we do a lot of IPAs. I think that's our probably favorite style to drink. So it's a style we like to brew a lot. We have a vanilla porter. That's one of our flagship beers as well. So that gets sold. So as far as where you can buy our beers, we got a pretty limited spot, but we've got like Jack Spratt's down in Girdwood. We've got some beers over at Bread and Brew. Tent City just picked up the vanilla porter. Garcia's Pizza Man goes through a ton of our beer. That's a local legendary pizza spot in Eagle River. So they support the hell out of us, and it's appreciated. So, yeah, we're just, unfortunately, with the COVID hitting, that's when our kind of expansion just got opened up and approved. And we had all this room, and we were getting after it. And then everything, of course, shuts down. So our plans to get our beer out were kind of squashed at that point. But so we're hoping if we can get back into that, because that was our plan, is to get it out to more restaurants and that type of thing, whereas we didn't have the room to do that before. So hopefully we can get through this COVID and get back to the real normal and get our beers out there.
So how are you weathering the COVID?
Been pretty good for us. I mean, we did take a dip down when they closed it, but we were obviously fortunate to have the luxury to have beer to go, so it wasn't a total loss. And that kind of kept us afloat. And then since it's opened back up a little bit, I mean, we actually honestly had our best 3 months of the summer this summer during the pandemic. So again, having a little more space inside now with our expansion has given us pretty good foothold there to keep the doors open and keep people spread out and safe. And then we, like many other breweries did, we're not in the prime location for outdoor seating. So, but we were able to, me and my boys built some cedar picnic tables, and we got the permit to go out in the parking lot. It'd be nice if we were on a rooftop or looking over some green pasture, but it is what it is, and that was kind of a nice change too, and that allowed us to keep going and not lose too much. So I think we weathered it pretty good. I hope most of the breweries did.
Yeah, well, it's going to get interesting here, and this time of year is a lot of that outdoor seating has to go away. I know a lot of people did that, but it'll be interesting to see if people can manage when there's snow all over the ground.
Yeah, I joke about that too, but then I look at Bobby up at Hoodoo, and mind you, their Fairbanks people are a little more hardy than the southern Alaska folks. But yeah, that's definitely going to put a damper on things, because I think we're just not as hardy as those Fairbanks people. They'll be out there at, you know, zero, you know, five below, huddled around their fires, and I don't know if that's going to work here or not, but we'll see.
Well, you got to come down here for our Frozen River Fest in February. I don't know if we'll be having it this year or not, but whenever we have it again, you haven't lived till you've done a beer festival outdoors in February.
Yeah, I was there 2 years ago. We were down there, and it was great. Actually, it was great when we didn't have our heater didn't work, and the beer was flowing perfect. And then they finally fixed the heat, and they had it blowing right under our kegs, and then a beer came out all foamy. So it was pick your poison there. Either be warm or cold, and the beer flows a little better.
So let me ask you one final question. Do you guys have what I would call a brewing philosophy? You mentioned that you really like IPAs. Is there any other beer styles or that you really aspire to? Do you like British stuff, German stuff, Belgian stuff? Any, you know, any kind of an underlying philosophy behind your brews?
I've always said the philosophy of our brewing as home brewers, you know, obviously we brew beers that we like to drink. But like I said before, with me coming on and I was kind of the main brewer in the garage, I'll have to learn on the new system along with Swanee as my my tutor. But I want to get into more Belgians, and I really like some sours. I love Gabe's stuff that he does there. I've tried the kettle sours a couple times. I'm not a huge fan of those, but the more traditional sour that take a little longer, I really love the complexity of those beers, and look forward to with the expansion we have in the room to have a little barrel program.
Have you got any barrels yet?
We do. We've got five Buffalo Trace bourbon barrels, which we actually brewed a 8% stout back in, right before COVID hit, March, that we put in the barrels, and it's been sitting there ever since. And we just pulled out a couple kegs for our anniversary so we can share that with people. And then we just got this week just brewed another barley wine. We haven't done a barley wine since 2016. So, yeah, kind of getting back into some beers we haven't done in a while. So it's kind of fun.
Well, sounds great. Well, hey, Reed, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. We really appreciate it and wish you every success. And hopefully soon, as you say, we'll have this virus behind us and it'll be easier for folks to get up there from down here and check you out.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, thanks for having us on. Appreciate it.
In last month's feature, I talked about what made bottle-conditioned beers special. In this month's, I'd like to talk about another formerly common way to brew beer, which fell out of favor over a century ago, but which is making a strong comeback. The fooder. That's spelled F-O-E-D-E-R. So, what is a fooder? A fooder, in its simplest form, is a large barrel. When exactly it becomes a fooder rather than just an oversized barrel is somewhat vague, but the line is often drawn at 600 liters. That's around 160 gallons, or roughly three times the size of the average oak barrel. Fooders are also distinguished by the lengths required to construct them. They require a specially trained team of experts who work together to complete construction over a period of weeks or even months, depending on the size of the vessel. The world's largest fooder belongs to the makers of the Apéritif beer in France. Though no longer operative, it once held up to 1 million liters. Its construction consumed 200 trees and required 18 years to complete. The obvious difference in size makes for a number of differences in fooder construction as compared to barrel production. Most notably, fooders usually have manways, allowing for access to the inside. This can make cleaning the inside a bit more comfortable, but it also means that staves must be sawn short, which can reduce the structural integrity of the vessel. In fact, all staves for fooders must be sawn rather than split due to their size. Splitting wood is a more painstaking and less efficient process, but it preserves the medullary ray of the tree, making for a much hardier stave. Therefore, in fooder making, extra care must be taken to preserve the grain and avoid knots. Aside from the manway, fooders are also far more likely to have other bells and whistles, such as permanently mounted spray balls, which can spout a variety of cleaning and preservative solutions within the fooder as needed. The shape of a fooder tends to be more cylindrical than the standard barrel shape, as they are generally immobile and kept upright. Some may even come with ornamental touches. Fooder construction involves contemplation and patience. Scaffolding is erected that encircles the work in progress and allows access by the builders. A typical fooder producer will turn out perhaps 200 tanks a year. Compare this with similar-sized cooperages that produce tens or even hundreds of thousands of barrels annually. Cranes and forklifts are needed to move them along the phases of their construction, as well as out the door once completed, a far cry from the easy roll along the way of the individual barrel. Indeed, the movement of a fooder is a serious undertaking and can be disastrous if not done with great care. Weeks of labor and thousands of dollars can be undone with a heavy hand. Often, fooders will have to be disassembled just to make it in the brewery's door, only to be painstakingly reassembled inside. Case in point, the massive fooders of Anchorage Brewing Company, whose careful reassembly was personally supervised by owner Gabe Fletcher. Before they need to move a fooder, though, a brewer must acquire one. This is no small feat in itself, as demand far outstrips supply. Similar to the used barrel market, craft brewers have historically bought fooders secondhand, most commonly from vintners who need fresh fooders for their wine. Or the vintner will exchange a used fooder for a fresh one from the fooder maker for a discounted rate. The fooder maker can then resell the used fooder to a brewer for a premium, as the mellowed notes of a used vessel imparts are often preferable to brewers. Despite the added shipping costs, American buyers often preferred European coopers for their expertise and heritage. After all, they are the progenitors of the craft. But America has recently become home to its own fooder maker, and while there are cooperages in the U.S. that can maintain and repair, St. Louis-based Fooder Crafters of America is the first of its kind. Fooder Crafters was founded by Justin Saffel and Matt Walters, who have been crafting fooders from American white oak for several years, with vessels ranging in size from 7 to 250 barrels at a cost of $6,900 to $43,000, respectively. Though that may seem exorbitant, their prices are an estimated 20% cheaper than European competition, even without shipping costs. Here in Alaska, Fooder Crafters has supplied fooders to both the Anchorage Brewing Company and the new Lat 65 Brewing Company in Fairbanks. So what does it mean to acquire a fooder? The cost of a fooder is just one of many considerations due to the large investment of resources and risk involved. One must understand the most intricate vagaries of the wood aging process and how they will differ from a barrel to a fooder. They must also have a firm grasp on the maturation and blending processes of fooder beer, as it can quickly turn for worse or better. Lastly, a brewer in possession of a fooder must know at least basic barrel maintenance, which becomes increasingly complicated as the size of the vessel increases, although not entirely different. All that being said, using a fooder for fermentation allows a brewer to produce some very unique beers. While there are tons of breweries aging beer in barrels, there aren't many out there doing their primary fermentation in wood. This was the way all beers would have been brewed 200 years ago, prior to the development of stainless steel. Contact with the wood during fermentation imparts some unique character to the beer produced, as well as making a beautiful display of wooden vessels in the brewery. If you want to see what I'm talking about, pay a visit to the Anchorage Brewing Company and check out their fermentation vessels. As Alaskans, we are lucky to have relatively easy access to Anchorage Brewing Company, as it is regarded as one of the best in the world when it comes to brewing in wooden vessels. So the next time you're in Anchorage, stop in at 148 West 91st Avenue and take a gander at what a truly amazing collection of fooders looks like. Oh, and you might want to try some of the beer they produce while you're there. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. For our next year interview, we're lucky to have Stefan and Zach from Bleeding Heart Brewery back again to tell us what's up in Palmer. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Doing well, sir, doing well in, you know, light of everything.
Yeah, good hearing from you again. So you guys are like somewhere betwixt and between in your move from your old digs into your new location in the Alaska Picker. So why don't you tell us where things stand right now?
Yeah, actually we're getting a lot closer to being in that new building than before. Currently we're just waiting on I think just one piece of paper, and then we can start serving beer out of the new tap room. But construction finishes this week. The new brew equipment from Alpha Brewing will be in next Friday, and so we're hitting the ground running here shortly.
So why don't you describe your new place?
So if you've been to Palmer, you've obviously seen the iconic water tower in the center of town. right below that, you will find the Alaska Picker Building, some of the coolest junk in town, and now some of the okayest beer. We're going to be in the back third of the shop. We actually partitioned it all out, so we'll have the shop in the front, and then we'll have the brewery in the back. We'll have an outdoor entrance. We'll also have some outdoor seating. We'll have roughly 15 beers available to be on tap. We're having a little prep kitchen as well for bar snacks and light noshes, as well as our usual seating style and opportunity for people to come in, hang out, and shoot the breeze with each other.
So you said you're just waiting on a piece of paper to open. Have you got beer to sell if you're still waiting on your brewing equipment to show up? Where do you stand on that front?
Yeah, so we were thankfully able to brew a little bit in our old location while we were technically closed to the public because of COVID. So I have a little bit of back stock that we're going to be putting on tap as soon as we open, even though we won't have any brew equipment set up. And in true Bleeding Heart form, we ended up only sitting on barrel-aged barley wines and stouts and sours and imperials. So we're going to be opening the gates with, I think, 10 different beers, and they're all going to be 8 to 12% ABV. So,
okay.
Yeah, get ready for that.
Yeah, okay. That sounds ambitious, yeah.
Well, it's all the stuff that we had for the the barreled beers that we do, all those corks and cages that we do in the fall, we had a lot of stock ready to go for bottling. But we figured, why sit on it and bottle it when we can just put it out? And so the stuff from last year's bottles, like Ominous Hippopotamus, Dudley Do Worse, Self-Immolation, all these beers, instead of being sold in the bottle, because most of them we sold out of the bottles within the first week of having them. So we'll actually have them on tap for you to try by the glass.
Well, that sounds great. And you guys have never really been on tap anywhere else. When you get your new system up and running and stuff like that, do you have any plans to start packaging for any kind of distribution? Or are you going to stick to strictly out-the-door sales there at the tap room?
Yeah, so actually, toward the end of our time at the old space, I believe we were in close to 20 different locations.
Okay.
Around the state. And that was... We were able to do that because we weren't selling beer out of the tap room. We were just primarily focusing on distribution. So, but now with the upgrade in brew system, we're hoping to be able to have plenty of beer on tap in the tap house, and also probably resume most, if not all, of those distribution locations, all the way from Fairbanks down to Homer.
Cool.
So,
how big is your new system going to be? Are you going with a 10 barrel? I can't remember.
So we did a 5-barrel with okay. 4 5-barrel unitank
okay.
fermenters.
So how badly has COVID-19 monkey wrenched your plans?
It knocked them pretty hard. We were definitely expecting to be open prior to October. We've been saying 2020 for an open date all year. But COVID really hammered our shipping. It hammered the build, it hammered the loan process. Every opportunity there was for a delay based on COVID, it was there. We were delayed at every turn. So we're still saying opening date 2020. We still have at least 2.5 months.
Yeah, well hopefully, if you're just waiting for one piece of paper, that won't keep you waiting too long. Who are you waiting for? The ABC?
I was gonna say, because bureaucracy has always been an efficiency, right?
Right, right.
one piece of paper should never hold us up. Hmm. We're just waiting on the final actions of DEC so we can send it to AMCO, and then AMCO can come out and give us our enforcement walkthrough and give us our sheet. But we are all the preliminary moves for our Alaska State Brewing License. We already got that done. They just have to issue it once they get the DEC.
Well, like you say, that's the world of COVID. Nothing worked fast beforehand, but it's slow as molasses in January now.
Precisely.
So have you guys got any, you're going to have your new system, you're going to have more capacity. Have you got any new, I shudder to ask you guys crazy beers coming, but because I know you, all your beers are practically by definition crazy. But you got any new things in the offing that you're going to spring on us in the next couple of 3 months when you once you get your system up and running?
Well, the one time I'm allowed to brew a year is our Sasquatch Day, and that passed a week ago. So I'm really looking forward to getting into the new system and getting the opportunity to make my one time a year brew of Sasquatch barley wine. And in this case, instead of being just one barrel of experimentation, it'll have the opportunity to be five barrels of experimentation.
So it's, I mean, it's not going to be the craziest beer we've ever done, but I'm definitely the most nervous about that when it comes to brewing over the next couple of months.
It sounds like with your new setup, you're going to have to expand your staff, right? If you're going to have a kitchen and, so are you're looking at hiring somebody? You already got somebody lined up?
Yeah, so, I mean, right off the bat, we have a friend of mine, Mason Minturn. He's going to be filling in the role as basically head chef and kind of manager of the kitchen. And I think right off the bat, we're all just going to have to be, you know, all hands on deck and fulfilling multiple roles until we start seeing some money come in from beer sales. And then we'll be looking at hiring a couple more people. But I think to start with, I'm going to be a prep cook and a tap girl and a bar maid and a brewer, and Zach will, you know, stand in the background as usual. Oh yeah, he's gonna, like, you know,
he's the idea pictures. He's the idea man. Yeah,
right. So, right, and put stuff on social media, you know, the really important stuff.
So
hey, I'll wear a dress and pour beers. I've done it before.
That's true. That's a good point.
So what hours do you guys think you're going to be keeping when, you know, assuming once you get your piece of paper and you're open, how many days of the week you're going to be open and what hours?
I mean, probably to start with just Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Okay.
Until I can get the new system installed and get some beer flowing. And then after that, I'm hoping to be open close to 6 days a week, if not more, you know, if not the full week. It just totally depends on how quickly I can churn some beers out for everyone to start consuming. So,
but that is your plan then, to be open basically 6 days a week through the winter and everything like that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We'll hold a pretty steady schedule through winter. And then just like we did before, we'll adjust some of our hours for summer. We'll, once we get a feel for how the downtown crowd is gonna, you know, what hours they're coming in, then we'll be able to expand those in the summertime, because theoretically next summer we'll have tourists.
Theoretically, yes. Everybody's got their fingers crossed for that one.
And yeah. If not, we'll have, you know, people from in-state coming to see us.
Yeah. Well, hey, anything else you guys want to talk about that's happening? Sounds like you're on track, even if you're a little behind where you wanted to be. You're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I think, you know, just stay tuned. If you don't have us on Facebook or social media right now, give us a follow so you can be up to date with what's going on our end, because we try to keep everyone in the loop as we go through this process, just as we did the first time. I'm just really excited to see people again. albeit through a mask, it's just going to be, you know, it's going to be nice to have a place where the people we like can congregate and we can, you know, talk crap and drink crappy beer.
Well, hey, I look forward to it, guys, and appreciate you taking the time out to talk with us today. So good luck, and, you know, keep us in the loop as far as when you get your doors open.
Hey, we absolutely will, Bill, and we appreciate this. And you make sure to come see us as soon as you can.
I will, as soon as they'll let me out of my cage down here.
That's right. All right, brother, we appreciate all this, just this opportunity to have a conversation with you.
Hey, you guys take care. All righty, we'll talk soon. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello, and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. I don't know that there's a beer more pathologically, frequently, and substantively misunderstood than pumpkin beer. I'm not talking about the perennial debate over whether it's too early for pumpkin beer to hit the taps and shelves. No, I'm talking about the general lack of light shown on the origins of pumpkin beer and how it has evolved along with the craft beer movement. Pumpkin beer has a long history, but with each generation it retains the name while changing what we should expect, actually to be expected when we take our first sip. Today, whether the end of September is too soon or not, we're going to discuss where pumpkin beer came from, how it got here, and where it's going. As American as apple pie, the saying goes, but it could just as easily have been as American as pumpkin pie. To your average colonist in North America in the 17th and 18th century, pumpkin products of all kinds, pies, mashes, beers, breads, you name it, were ubiquitous. Why? Because there was a veritable unending supply of the things. Pumpkins grow like weeds, wandering and weaving and wending, and it's no wonder that in an otherwise resource-strapped place like colonial America that pumpkins found their way into everything. As one popular saying went, "We have pumpkin at morning and pumpkin at noon. If it was not for pumpkin, we should be undone." This included, from the earliest days of the colonies, pumpkin beer. The beer was derived from the mashed and fermented pulp of pumpkin and probably not much else. Colonists had limited access to wheat and barley, and those were generally used for bread flour, with oats and other cereal grains used in cooking and for livestock feed. But pumpkins they had in abundance, and while contemporary recipes are scarce, there are frequent mentions of pumpkin and other adjunct ales in the writings and records of the time. Pumpkins were not used for their flavor, they were simply a source of starch, converted into fermentable sugars, just as with malted barley and other adjuncts. Apples, pears, squash, corn, and other local agricultural products were also used as a source of fermentable sugars, but pumpkin stood out in terms of its availability and its ability to produce, with some age, a fairly clean finished beer. While it would not have been unheard of to add spices and hops to pumpkin beer, there do not appear to have been any go-to flavoring additions. You might say that this was a rustic farmhouse product. Besides pumpkins, spruce tips, ginger, molasses, even ground ivy were added to the ad hoc recipes brewed by our colonial forebears. The popularity of pumpkin beer faded through the decades, however. No one has ever offered a specific reason for this shift, other than the most obvious one. As agriculture developed in the new United States and cereal grains became more readily available, the necessity of using pumpkins as starchy source material fell away. We can also assume that waves of emigrating British, German, and Czech brewers, accustomed to working with traditional brewing grains, would have had no particular reason to make use of the unfamiliar New World pumpkin. Whatever the reason, pumpkin beers had all but disappeared from the American brewing landscape until the 1980s. Necessity may be the mother of invention, but curious brewers are probably its quirky aunt. It is thanks to one such brewer that pumpkin beer re-entered the national drinking scene. In 1985, Bill Owens was brewing and selling beer at one of the first outposts of the craft beer movement, Buffalo Bill's Brewery in Hayward, California. Owens had run across a recipe for pumpkin beer in the writings of George Washington, in which Washington described the brewing operations at Mount Vernon. Intrigued, he jumped in with both feet, ordering seeds and growing his own pumpkins to use in early test batches. Roasted and then mashed in with a version of Bill's Amber Ale, the pumpkin added nothing much to the taste of the finished beer. It's at this moment that expectation met up with perception and led to innovation. When we think of pumpkin flavor, we are actually not thinking of the flavor of pumpkin. We're thinking of the flavor of pumpkin pie, which is driven not by the pumpkin, which is largely flavorless, but by cinnamon, clove, and other spices. Bill and other brewers quickly focused more on the spice blend used in pumpkin beers and pretty much abandoned altogether the use of pumpkins in their pumpkin beers. With a rich malt backbone and restrained hop character supplemented by spice additions, pumpkin beer began to define itself as a distinct fall seasonal style, even without the pumpkins. Today, the Brewers Association style guidelines differentiate between pumpkin slash squash beer, which is brewed with pumpkin and without spicing, and pumpkin spice beer, which may or may not contain pumpkin, but does use spices to create the evocative flavor profile. The Beer Judge Certification Program guidelines lay out the rough parameters of an autumn seasonal beer, which captures both. For professionals and homebrewers, pumpkin beer is as well known as it is derided for pushing its way onto shelves and taps too early each year. Brewers and drinkers alike get bored easily, so although there are still any number of mid-strength amber ales with pumpkin pie spices on the market, they're hardly alone. New and exotic variations on the pumpkin beer are now seasonal favorites. The original Buffalo Bill's pumpkin ale is still brewed and sold, and is joined by nationally distributed versions in the same vein. Dogfish Head's pumpkin ale comes to mind. Looking to pumpkin ales brewed in Alaska, Midnight Sun has two justly famed offerings. The first is Trickster, a beer brewed with pumpkin spices, allspice, ginger, and black pepper, then fermented with a Belgian yeast. At 7% alcohol by volume and 22 IBUs, it's their take on a traditional pumpkin beer. Midnight Sun's second pumpkin brew is named Treat, which is an anagram for the Royal Eccentric Ale Treatment. This beer is an Imperial Chocolate Pumpkin Porter, brewed with spices, cocoa nibs, and pumpkin. Darker and heavier than its brother Trickster, it weighs in at 7.8% alcohol by volume and 30 IBUs. Speaking of pumpkin porters, Alaskan Brewing used to produce one as part of its pilot series, but it has been retired. Smaller breweries around the state also produce pumpkin brews this time of year. Check with your local craft brewery to see what it might be releasing soon. Whether you love them or hate them, perhaps the most remarkable thing about pumpkin beer is that in them we can clearly see the connection between the various pumpkin beers of today and their forebears in the 17th and 18th century. Brewers in the 21st century not only appreciate and recognize the brew with what you've got handy ethos, they embrace it heartily. Pumpkin beer is, quietly, an exemplar of exactly what we want to see in craft beer. The use of local and sustainable ingredients, creative recipe design, and a product that is both flavorful and fuels our nostalgia and whimsy. We'll be right back with our final interview this month. I'm Bill Howell, your host here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Next up, we've got an interview with Ben Milstein of Kodiak Island Brewing Company. Hey, Ben, how are you today, sir?
Pretty good, Bill. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. So, how are things going on the Rock?
Well, I mean, in some ways, we're really lucky. There hasn't been a whole lot of disease here, so we're a little bit isolated, of course, and that helps. On the other hand, that means nothing has really started, and so it's hard to try and see the light at the end of the tunnel if you haven't even gotten to the tunnel yet. So, I mean, we were closed we were open just 3 hours a day for beer to go from a window by the counter for 4 months, and open, the tasting room has been open again for the last month and a half. And we did some measures, mitigation measures, of course. We had a temporary outdoor fenced-in area in the parking lot for a while with some spools that people could stand around and all. And then, meanwhile, I built a deck on the other side of the building. And so as soon as we got that done, we were able to get the parking back. So people have been enjoying that, and that helps. I bought a small still and kind of trying to get that up and running, but the licensing is very difficult, and it's a complicated operation, so it'll take me a little while to get that going, but I'm hoping that that'll kind of diversify our market a little bit and hopefully make the business sustainable again, even in these anemic times.
So is that going to be the Kodiak Island Distillery? Is it going to be under the brewing name? You're going to have a separate brand name for it?
No, just Kodiak Island Still. And, yeah, so we'll still figuring all that out, too. But, yeah, so we'll see where it goes.
And what about you plan to do whiskey eventually? I think you got to age that for a few years.
Yeah, for sure whiskey because, you know, we have grain, so that just is a natural thing to do. And then I think we'll do some gin at least because there's all sorts of possibilities for local ingredients and aromatics. And we'll just see how it develops. We don't have a lot of local fermentables. That not in a quantity that you could really do, you know, rum or brandy or something. But there's lots of possibilities. So I'll just see how it evolves.
You're going to sell, this is going to be like your beers? You're only going to sell them on the rock? Or are you planning on sending some of that whiskey north to us?
I don't have distribution plans at this point. I'm kind of taking this one step at a time, so I'm not really trying to make that call. It'll for sure just be local to begin with. I mean, the whole idea is mostly to enhance the appeal of the tasting room to a larger segment of the population. But, of course, it's much easier to distribute than beer since it's not perishable and right. it is so much denser for volume. So that means that we could distribute easier in the long run. But you know, I want to nail down recipes before we kind of try to compete at that level. That's not in my plans at this point.
Wow, that's really exciting. So what else is up? How's you know, obviously your sales been slow, but have you produced anything new and exciting in the brewery? Any new beers or anything?
Well, let's see. I guess I don't think we've released anything. I mean, we're always releasing new beers, but they're not always beers that we've never done before. And so I can't think that, of a beer that we've done recently that is totally brand new, but the specialties are always changing, and so that keeps it fun and interesting. And you know, we didn't brew for 6 months, and so we've just started brewing again. We've only brewed one batch so far, and so we're just getting back into brewing. And right now, it's our standard still, the you know, Liquid Sunshine, North Pacific, Termination Point, stuff like that.
So you were shut down for that long simply because you had so much beer on hand and demand was so low?
Yeah, you know, we had like 9,000 gallons of beer, and we were only selling a few gallons a day. So there was no brewing necessary. It was terrible.
You guys probably got hit pretty hard by the no tourist season down there as well.
Yeah, you know, tourism isn't the biggest thing here, but it is something. But it's just that people just weren't, even though we were still open for beer to go, I think a lot of people just were, it was easier for them to just get everything at Safeway and go home and not make extra stops. And, you know, there just wasn't a lot. We had people, you know, really loyal customers who would come here on a regular basis to get all their beer. But, you know, I think most people just kind of went with whatever was easiest. And so it was pretty slow. Tourism took a hit, but, you know, fishing was down, and Coast Guard people weren't supposed to, you know, were not supposed to go out too much. And so there was, very sparse.
Well, I'm glad you're kind of on the other. Sounds like you're a little bit on the other side of that, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, our sales aren't, you know, the people are still reluctant, or a lot of people are reluctant to come into a tasting room and hang out, but a lot of people are not. So we get we get some traffic every day now. It isn't, I'm not sure it's quite at a sustainable level, but, you know, there's also been some assistance to help us through all of this. And so that has been, you know, crucial. And when and if the assistance dries up, assuming the economy doesn't kind of bounce back to something more normal, that'll be an issue. But so we'll just, you know, have to wait and see what all those factors are, you know. Hard to forecast.
Well, anything else you want to tell folks about, Ben? Anything coming up that they should be aware of?
I guess my big focus recently has just been on the deck and on the still. And I guess the other things that we're thinking about are not fully baked yet. The thing to do right now is a lot of brainstorming and open-mindedness to creativity. Just kind of figure out, okay, if we can't expect the economy to get back to normal, then what sorts of things should we be considering to pivot? And so there's just I've just spent a lot of time, you know, pipe dreaming, kind of, you know, what could we do? What could we do that's different that will kind of more meet the needs in the moment?
Well, hey, thanks for taking the time to talk to us, and we wish you every success. I'm looking forward to trying the product of that still once you get it licensed and up and running.
Yeah, me too. I'm dying to get it up and running. So, yeah, thanks for calling. I appreciate your interest. Stay safe.
Hey, you too. Looking forward to my next visit down there. I'm not sure when it'll be, but it's on my to-do list.
All right, great.
This is KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment. Hello, and welcome back to the final segment of this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. In this month's beer gear, I'm going to make another book recommendation. Last month, Tom Acitelli released his new book, Pilsner, How the Beer of Kings Changed the World. I met Tom 10 years ago in Denver at the Great American Beer Festival. We shared a table at the press luncheon. At the time, he was working on his first beer book, The Audacity of Hops, which he eventually published in 2013 and then revised and updated in 2017. It's an outstanding look at the history of the American craft beer movement. So I was very excited to check out his new book on beer, and it did not disappoint. Pilsner shatters myths about Pilsner's very birth and its immediate parentage. Acitelli also pops the top on new insights into the Pilsner style and into beer in general through a character-driven narrative that shows how Pilsner influenced everything from modern-day advertising and marketing to today's craft beer movement. It's a remarkable story, one that started in a supernova of technological, political, and demographic shifts in the mid-1800s, and that continued in the craft breweries of today. If you're interested in the history of beer, especially its history in America from the mid-19th century on, this is a great book for you. A paperback copy runs just over 280 pages and has a cover price of $19.99. I strongly recommend picking one up and reading it. Plus, if you haven't read The Audacity of Hops, why not pick up a copy of that one as well? Well, that's it for this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. Our closing beer quote this month is from Queen Victoria. Quote, "Give my people plenty of beer, good beer, and cheap beer, and you will have no revolution among them." Until next time, I'm Bill Howell here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. Cheers.